Okay. So let's say organizing this meeting is very rewarding to see the respect and the warmth that so many people have for Stanley. We have Song Jin coming from Korea, Lars from Sweden, Charlie and Pierre from the East Coast, and quite a number of people couldn't be here for a number of reasons, but we have an online guest book which now has contributions from Jeff Chu, Charlie Schwartz, Nina Byers, and Michio Kaku. And actually a couple of Stanley's longest acquaintances from Birmingham couldn't be here. Jim Langer, our own Jim Langer, had plans for this date already a year ago. Anyway, while planning this, it's been interesting to reflect for the first time in a while on graduate school and you know, the work back then. And so I'd like to share that with you. And it's interesting that as with Nathan, I'd like to start with my warm-up problem. And in fact, this is going to be a long story. So the warm-up problem is simply stated. It's to write down the action for a U1 gauge field coupled to an electrically charged field and a magnetically charged field. And that simply stated problem is in fact very rich physically, and especially from the perspective of physics 30 years later. Now, one possible answer, just to get into the problem, one possible answer that I didn't think of at the time is that maybe this theory doesn't exist. And the reason it might not be the following reason. We know even with just the electric charge, the theory doesn't exist because there's a Landau pole. The coupling blows up in the ultraviolet. But we also know that if the coupling is weak, it takes a long time to blow up, and we understand how we can use quantum electrodynamics as an effective theory. If you have both an electric charge and a magnetic charge, then because of the Dirac quantum condition, one of them has to be of order one or larger. And so whichever is larger seems as blow up. So you don't get an effective theory. You have a theory where within a factor of E, the coupling is infinity. This theory just doesn't exist. By the way, I should have said, I did not solve my warm-up problem, and I'm explaining now why. But actually, this argument isn't quite right. If you think about it, okay, there's only one coupling. The E and G are reciprocal to each other. And so what I've just told you is that if E starts out one order, it essentially immediately flows to infinity, and that's in the opposite direction, the arrows. If G, the reciprocal, starts out large, it flows to infinity essentially immediately. So you picture that there should in fact be a theory which does exist at all. And so in some sense, the electric plus magnetic theory is better than the purely electric theory, because it exists not only as an effective theory, but in fact it really has a UV fixed point. It really exists as a continuum theory. So in that sense, it's a well-posed system. However, this is you know, in the 70s, thinking was very perturbative, very classical. This is a theory which has no classical field limit. Classical field limit means that you can take to zero and expand around it. This is something that in the years since we've you know, found in many, many contexts, but it was certainly at that time not something one ever thought of. A quantum field theory that exists as a purely quantum thing and doesn't have a classical limit. But this also means that my warm wasn't solvable, at least not in the terms that it was set, because at least let's look for the action for this theory. And the action is basically a classical concept. Theories like this, which are intrinsically quantum, in general don't have actions. They have no right to have an action because you can't take a classical limit, which is the limit in which the action is meaningful. So again, this is a very modern perspective, but it suggests the reason why I found the problem so hard. Now, as you look at this, you realize, okay, the arrows are the flow towards the ultraviolet, so you turn them around to get the flow towards the infrared. And so you see that this quantum field theory should be constructible probably rather in many ways by taking quantum theories And you know, this is a natural infrared fixture, natural thing to arise in the infrared. And again, that's a point of view which is, again, comes from the after my graduate years, but it has been constructed some years later. So again, my graduate years, by the way, were 1977 to 1980, just a few years after asymptotic freedom. I guess during what turned out to be, for Stanley, a brief vacation from string theory, when he was thinking about quantum field theory. So anyway, it was some time later that Argiers and Douglas actually proved that this theory exists. They constructed it in the following way. If you start from a very different starting point, an SU3 gauge theory with n equals 2 supersymmetry. Now, over most of its moduli space, the gauge symmetry is broken down to U1 cross U1, and the spectrum is just two free photons. But there is a curve where there's a curve in the moduli space where there's a massless charge field. There's a curve where there's a massless magnetically charged field. These intersect. And Argiers and Douglas are able to do a number of exact calculations to support that the solution to my warm-up problem sits at that point. That is, this is a quantum field theory whose fields really are just a U1 gauge field, an electrically charged field, a magnetically charged field, and in this case, they're super partners. But actually, Argiers and Douglas, this is a great and important and deep paper, but they actually went a little bit further. They actually claimed to solve my warm-up problem, that is, to write a Lagrangian describes the effect of physics at this point. And then they did. They started with this is actually written down by John Schwartz and Hashok Sen, to describe the free U1 gauge field, but to do it in a duality invariant way. So there are what look like two gauge fields, alpha and beta run over 1 and 2, two gauge fields with this somewhat funny looking action. It's not that funny looking. It's not covariant. It can't be covariant. And there's actually more gauge invariance. There are four gauge functions, not two, because there's a gauge function for A sub I and a gauge function for a separate gauge function for the time-like components of A and two copies of each. So there's enough gauge symmetry that, in fact, one can gauge this down to just a single gauge field, but depending on the choice on the gauge you choose, you get sort of either what you would think of as the electric vector potential or the magnetic vector potential. This is very cute. And so what Argiers and Douglas say is simply we'll take Schwartz and Sen and we'll couple the electric vector potential to the electric charge and the magnetic vector potential to the magnetic charge. And why didn't I think of that? Well, you know, it doesn't work. That's why. And for you can see why it doesn't work, because this funny gauge invariance isn't consistent with the couplings that you need. In particular, if you make the psi variation, it would require the electric charge density and the magnetic charge density to vanish. And so this doesn't make so. In fact, it works at the free level, but it's not a solution to the problem of how you would couple to electric and magnetic sources. And so you might think, okay, you just need to be a little cleverer, you just need some more fields, but it's really a much deeper problem than that. And one way to see, there's a couple ways to see why it's a deeper problem. One is the following. If I think about the path integral of the magnetic fields over the magnetic charges, there'll be configurations like this, where you have a monopole here and an anti-monopole here, and you know that in the presence of a monopole and an anti-monopole, the electrically charged fields don't live, they're not functions. They're sections of a bundle. There's a direct string that stretches from here to here. So in fact, any framework in which you just integrate over functions can't possibly work because the electric field, the charge field is not a function. It's a section of a bundle, but the bundle, which bundle it is, depends on in fact where you are in the magnetic path integral. So these two integration spaces are coupled together in some very complicated way. Anyway, so I was doing reading. I found these neat papers by C.N. Yang, who basically described, fiber bundles, vector, whatever. And I took them to Stanley and said, look, he's already solved it. You just use these bundles. And he explained, no, the problem is really to second quantize this. So I kind of got stuck there. I didn't make any further progress. I'm not sure what the answer would have been. But another way to think about but I'll give you a couple of answers in a second. Another way to think about why this is so hard is that that the action we know for the electrically charged field is only defined modulo 2 pi. This is where the Dirac quantization comes from. The action that I showed you before, the Argyris-Douglas action, is a well-defined action. There's no mod 2 pi. The action is not even smart enough to know that Dirac quantization has to be satisfied. So this is why no strategy of just writing down fields in a clever way is going to work. You need somehow to figure out what the functional integral space is. So actually, this problem has been solved, but not in expected ways. One actually came shortly after my attempts, which is Brantner and Zwanziger just said something very natural and a little bit formal, but I think it makes sense, which is rather than second quantize in this way, you first quantize. You replace the path integrals over these fields with sums over the world lines of the charges. And this is a somewhat formal, but it's an equivalence. And once you do this, then for a given configuration of charges, the action for the gauge fields is actually well-defined modulo 2 pi, and you can integrate it out. And while it's a bit formal, I believe that this actually makes sense on the lattice. It's very much like compact QED, but with some fine tuning to keep the charge fields light. So if you had to know the physics of this system, I believe that there's and you had a really big computer, then I think this provides a solution to the problem. Another solution is really just provided by Argyris and Douglas, which is to say you just write down the action of the n equals 2 SU3 gauge theory, maybe with soft Suzy break and get rid of some of the extra fields you don't want, and you let it flow to the fixed point. And of course, this is a style of answer that we know is very common these days for these theories that have which are intrinsically quantum, which don't have classical limits. In many cases, the only way we now know how to construct them is in this way, flowing from a system that we can construct. In this way, it's much like the theory of multiple M2 brains in 11 dimensions before you start overfolding, where again, the only way we know how to construct that theory is by flowing to infinite coupling in a two-dimensional gauge theory. So to summarize, my warm-up problem was in the same category of difficulty as writing down the quantum theory of multiple M2 brains. Okay. They say that people are much influenced by their advisor's scientific style. In this case, I think Stanley was really just reinforcing natural tendencies of my own. But when I got to my second postdoc, after a while, Howard Georgi pulled me aside and said, Joe, it's okay to work on doable problems. That's the longest thing I'll tell you. It kind of set the pattern for the 3 years that followed. The next problem, before I describe the problem, I didn't solve the next problem either, but it is solvable because Anton Kapustin solved it a couple years ago. But let me, before I describe the problem, let me give you the big picture. So the desire was to understand quark confinement. And there was a strategy which I sort of understood in this way. At least this was one of the strategies. It was first to construct the Tuft operators. So Stanley had pioneered this picture that this mysterious phenomenon of quark confinement, in fact, was a very familiar thing. It was just the Meissner effect, but with electric and magnetic variables exchanged. And so the strategy was to construct the Tuft operators, the dual to the Wilson loops, extract from them the magnetic vector potential, the analog of Okay, the magnitude of the vector potential. Construct the Hamiltonian out of this vector potential, or maybe a little less ambitiously, construct some sort of approximate vacuum, and then demonstrate confinement. Okay, and so we don't believe that for QCD we can quite do this, but there really still is a puzzle today that we believe that n equals 4 super Yang Mills has a self-duality. We believe that it should be possible in principle, not the last step, but the first few steps, it should be possible to start from the usual, the electroform of the theory, and change variables in the path integral and construct these dual variables. And it remains a deep problem that we don't know how to do that. In fact, I might remind you, though, that Stanley solved a similar such problem. One of the simplest but richest examples of a duality, a weak strong of a duality, is the Stein-Gordon-Pearing duality, where you have a single quantum theory, one of whose limits is classical Stein-Gordon theory, and one of whose classical limits is the massive Pearing model. And in this case, Stanley was able to, and other people too over the years, was able to actually construct the operators of the fermionic theory in terms of the operators of the bosonic theory. And so if you can do it there, why can't you do it for n equals 4 supersymmetric Yang Mills? It remains a really interesting question. So the next problem I'll just describe briefly, but I want to mention it for a particular reason. It was the following. Wilson loops are classified by representations of the gauge group, G. Tuff loops, so what tuff loops are here's the loop, and they're singular gauge transformations. As you wind around the curve on which the loop is defined, you have a gauge transformation that describes some non-trivial path in the group. And so tuff loops are naively classified by the topology of the group, by the center of the group, in fact. And that's the center is a much smaller thing than the space of representations. This is just the n-ality for SUN, while there's an infinite number of representations. If there is this duality, then there should exist, in fact, a larger set of tuff loops classified by the dual group. And the problem was to find this finer set of tuff loops. So this is interesting. So one reason this is interesting. First of all, so Nathan mentioned the reading assignment he was given. This was my reading assignment, and it's interesting that this is still the first thing that you're told to read if you want to get involved in this geometric Langlands program. So one of the themes looking back on my graduate years is how many of the things Stanley was thinking about are still important problems and are still lively today. Anyway, I wrote down some things that were formal and might have been correct. Here's actually, again, Kapustin solved it. But the problem was always that they were kind of singular on the curve, and they weren't so well defined. But I want to show you one equation. So this actually is, again, this is the style of this is very, so this is not so different from Stanley's soliton operators. But the reason, this is scanned from my thesis, which was written during the first and thankfully brief period of scientific typesetting, where there was a Unix thing, TROF, which was able to continuously control a typewriter carriage, and so it could build a beta out of a three and a vertical bar. It could build an alpha out of a lowercase o and a couple of single quotes. The integral sign is really ghastly. I think it's a vertical bar and a bunch of single quotes. So this system, it's not like this system was displaced by tech. This system died on its own, on its own merits. Anyway, so I was trying something in the style of what you saw for the Stein-Gordon Fermion operators, which is an explicit function of the fields of the starting of the dual theory. And what Kapustin did is to kind of simplify it. I think it ultimately is probably an isomorphism, but Kapustin's point of view is certainly much simpler. It's simply to excise the curve C and to put singular boundary, put boundary conditions on the fields there, to specify boundary conditions on the field. And it seems to be right. It gives non-trivial and interesting answers, for example, for the conformal properties of the Wilson loop. So again, it was a problem which was sufficiently important that it needed to be solved, even if it took 30 years. So, just a few recollections. So Stanley was always extremely generous with his time. Stanley had actually three graduate students then. There was Susan Moore, who is now an MD, and there was Omer Kaimakalan, who sadly was diagnosed with leukemia during his first postdoc and passed away. But Stanley had three grad students. Whenever you went to ask him a question, he was free, and usually for the long periods that it took to exchange information. And I would ask questions and spend a long time trying to understand the answers. But I very clearly remember, on more than one occasion, I would be asking Stanley questions about gauge theory, and he would, you know, be staring away, as he often does, and say something about supergravity. And it wasn't just supergravity. It was either N equals 8 supergravity or D equals 11 supergravity. I'm not sure which. Now, these days, if you're talking to your advisor about gauge theories and they bring up supergravity, you don't even blink, of course, because we have gauge gravity duality, and this is, you know, the way things are. But this was 20 years before Maldacena. It was before the first superstring revolution. You know, gauge theory seemed to be at the limits of human comprehension, or beyond. And here's supergravity. Anyway, one can understand, of course, you know, Stanley thought a lot about Wilson loops, and clearly there were thoughts of connections between gauge theories and string theory with Wilson loops and Tufte loops being, you know, the dictionary. But when one thought about string theories of QCD, one always assumed until Maldacena, I thought, that gravity wasn't going to be part of the picture. So I never understood, really. Anyway, so this is basically, you know, the pattern of my graduate years. Stanley would say deep and forward-looking things, and I would be confused and not make much progress. And after about 3 years, he took pity on me and let me graduate. Now, many of you know that Berkeley does not have a dissertation defense. There's no oral defense of your dissertation. So actually, this is the first time that I've stood up in front of an audience with Stanley present and talked about my graduate research. And I don't think I'm passing. So I'd like to just explain that I did solve, just I'm doing well on time, I just explained that I did actually solve eventually. It took 20 years and a lot of help from Matt Strassler. But I did eventually solve part of my thesis problem. So my thesis problem, I'm taking it to be demonstrate confinement via monopole condensation in Yang-Mills theory, possibly using supergravity. So here's the paper, and just a brief outline. We assumed, again, ADS-CFT duality, where the gauge theory, we assume it's true, but of course the gauge theory there is conformal, it's not confining, it has a Coulomb law. You can, in the gauge theory, add explicit mass terms that would give mass to everything but the gauge fields. The only massless fields are Yang-Mills, the theory should confine. And now, since we have this solution via dual variables, we can ask, and we show this. So the mass terms perturb the boundary conditions on anti-sitter. They perturb the boundary conditions for the free-form fluxes. If you just solve naively, in fact, you find singularities, unphysical singularities in the interior. But with some cleverness, you realize that these singularities actually polarize the D3 brains and expand them out into either D5. There are several vacua, either D5 brains or NS5 brains. And the effect of this is that that the horizon of anti de Sitter space is replaced with a hard wall, and the infinite redshift of the horizon is replaced with a finite redshift. And so when you calculate the Coulomb force in the fashion described by Wan and by Su Zhang, In ADS, you have a string with a couple of external quarks that falls down to the horizon, and as you pull these apart, it gets closer and closer, and so its tension can be redshifted arbitrarily small. It really gives you a Coulomb law with the finite redshift. With the finite redshift, there is a minimum to the tension, and so there's an actual non-zero physical string tension. And so this theory, using ADS-CFT, can be shown to confine. And the mechanism really is, again, monopole condensation, because in the Higgs phase, where the D3 brains expand to a D5 brain, you have an explicit you have an explicit realization of the Higgs mechanism. This theory is S-dual. It's exactly S-dual, and so the confinement is due to condensation of models, monopoles in the S-dual theory. Okay, so that's my recounting of my graduate years, but actually in a few minutes I'd like to one of my students, Vishnu Jajala, became interested in our academic lineage and traced it back with the help of, there's a website, the Mathematics Genealogy Project, which may have you have something to explore, which has added more and more physicists over the years. Now the first, actually, as you go back in time, things were not as linear as they are now, and as I asked Stanley, and he said, Rudolf Perls is his advisor of record because he was the head of the lab, but Dick Dalitz and Paul Matthews were his real advisors. And Dick, in turn, names actually four people as his advisors, but if we just kind of make things simple and we trust what the Genealogy Project tells us, Dalitz and Matthews both had Kemmerer as their advisor, and Kemmerer had two advisors, Wenzel and Pauli. They had one again, Sommerfeld, Lindman, and it goes back to Felix Klein of the Klein bottle. Now, this website goes back quite a bit further, but past Klein, things tend to branch a lot. Here's one branch that goes back to the 1600s. And the most notable name on this branch is Carl Friedrich Gauss. Pretty cool. And here's the other branch, and it includes both Ohm, the brother of the guy with the unit, and Gustav Peter Dirichlet, which is, again, pretty fitting and cool. But Dirichlet himself had an extremely distinguished lineage. Poisson, Fourier, Lagrange, Euler, Bernoulli, Leibniz, Huygens, Schouten, and finally, Mersenne of the primes. That's very cool. Now, to be honest, if you look on the database, a large fraction of living, I don't know about physicists, but a fairly large, significant fraction of living mathematicians can, at some point or another join onto this. So it's pretty cool. Anyway, there's one more branch I want to mention. Not because you've heard of anybody on it, but because actually, the younger Bernoulli, Johann, had another advisor, and one can trace it back. The interesting thing here is how far back it goes. It goes back to 1380. Georgios Gemistos Plethon. It's truncated. That's 1380. And you can find things out about this fellow. He worked in Florence and Constantinople. He was an advocate of Plato. I guess this is what in those days passed for what we do now. He converted from Christianity to paganism. And I believe that he is the one who started the tradition of giving his graduate students impossible warm-up problems. So, thank you.